Window number 5, February 19th, 2024. Prelude. This section provides the critique of the book I have been pointing toward along the way, one that seeks to address its role as a cultural icon rather than simply an artifact, a hyperobject rather than one of the things I was holding in my hands. The quotation marks highlighting that distinction. I want to frame it epigraphically with a quote from each author that, while not materially connected with the narrative that follows, indexes, interestingly, via Hume and Kant, who play ongoing roles in both books, the cause-effect dynamic that haunts my own problematic relationship with that medium hyperobject, both globally, over the last 40 years, and locally, the last couple of weeks, writing about these two specific examples. Here's a quote from Marshall McLuhan's book. It was David Hume who, in the 18th century, demonstrated that there is no causality indicated in any sequence, natural or logical. The sequential is merely additive, not causative. Hume's argument, said Immanuel Kant, awoke me from my dogmatic slumber. Neither Hume nor Kant detected the hidden cause of our Western bias toward sequence as logic in the all-pervasive technology of the alphabet. And here's a quote from Timothy Morton's book. Hyperobjects are not just collections, systems, or assemblages of other objects. They are objects in their own right. Least of all, then, would it be right to say that hyperobjects are figments of the human imagination, whether we think imagination as the bundling of associations in the style of Hume, or as the possibility for synthetic judgments a priori with Kant. Hyperobjects are real, whether or not someone is thinking of them. Hyperobjects force us to acknowledge the immanence of thinking to the physical, but this does not mean that we are embedded in a life world. One of the interesting things about writing, at least as I experience it, is that it quite often reveals to me what I don't yet know, at least not consciously, rather than reports to you what I do know, or have come to know by reading someone else's writing as if it reports to me what they know. In other words, in practice, the stereotypical cause-effect-sequence we presume inheres to writing as a knowledge-making technology is inverted, at least for me. I'm not sure what, if anything, Hume, Kant, McLuhan, or Morton would say about that. But together, they somehow opened this final window for me to see something I never anticipated when I sat down to read these two books, or when I started to write about them, rendered now as a combination of personal testimony, all the ways the book has resisted my forward momentum through the ooze of the academy, to use a term I like from Morton, and manifesto, all the ways I have worked to counter that inbuilt resistance with a counter-resistance of my own. After my wife Carol died suddenly and unexpectedly in 2015, a deeply traumatic experience for me, I concluded that all the status-related mechanisms I had been indenturing myself to in order to progress through my profession were silly, stupid even, a lot of hoopla about nothing that mattered even in the short run, let alone the long run. All of this had been percolating inside me for decades as I endured the typical no-exit hazing routines imposed episodically in my profession, the book, the primary cudgel for enforcing their imperatives. Unfortunately, it took an event of this magnitude for me to see that the exit was right in front of me all the time. This window I'm looking back through now from the opposite side, finally free. The first book I wrote in the aftermath of this loss, this fall, Essays on Loss and Recovery, was founded on the walks in the woods I was then taking alone every morning, after many years having taken them together with my wife. It is a wonderful book, my best, I think. When I finished it, I had to decide what to do with it, publication-wise. And I knew instantly and instinctively, fiercely even, that I could not run a book this intimate through the gristmill of the extant publishing marketplace, which I had considerable experience with and had already come to believe was as abusive as the systems it supported. That would be scandalous, offensive in the extreme, both to my story and to the memory of my wife who inspired it. So I decided instead, without understanding anything about how or why, to publish it on my own. First, I created a personal website and uploaded my manuscript in PDF format free to anyone who wanted to read it, assuring thereby that the profanities of money and fame, those currencies of status in the capitalistic economy of the knowledge industry, would not sully it. Then I recorded and uploaded an audiobook version, also free. A few months later, more out of curiosity and boredom than ambition, I decided to see if I could create and publish a paperback version of this fall, entirely on my own. I had no interest in the old vanity press marketplace where one pays someone else a lot of money up front to end up with a stillborn simulation of a book. I wanted to do it all myself and to make a book that would be indistinguishable from all the others out there in the marketplace. I quickly found that the online tools necessary for this were freely available and extremely user-friendly. Upload a PDF, create a cover, press a few buttons, and a few days later, for a small expense, whatever price you set to purchase your book, which in my case, since I was not in it for profit, was cost of production, less than one-third of what a normally published book would cost, a very nice-looking book will arrive at your doorstep. The one I created for this fall looks and feels just like any book you might pick out from a bookstore shelf. Beautiful cover, via an image of a painting made by my son, an accomplished artist, quality materials, etc. I reported all of this casually and in passing to my chair at the time, who told me sternly, "You know, that book doesn't count, don't you?" It felt like he wished I wouldn't even tell anyone in the department I wrote it. It was that shameful. Most literally, of course, that meant it could not be counted additively in my personal inventory of credentials on my CV or my annual report, say, to leverage a raise. But more importantly, I knew, because it had not been processed through the approved machinery of the scholarly marketplace, that it had no legitimacy, could not be counted on by anyone who might want to read it. In other words, it was a book that was not the book in any of the certified ways such a designation was institutionally authorized. A no-book on a no-shelf, something like the no-self Morton talks about. I knew all of that full well, of course, which is what I told him, and I said that was exactly why I did it. I explained how, from my vantage point at the heart of this loss, where life and death collide and collude in the most awesome and awe-inspiring ways, none of that mattered to me any longer, not a whit, or ever would again. He looked at me as if I was lost instead of found, which was what I was trying to tell him, that I had found, through this no book, not just my no self, but freedom from external validation and control over my means of production, all in one fell swoop. Exhilaratingly rare in the academic marketplace, where what is called freedom is most often merely control, exerted invisibly, claustrophobically from the outside in until its work of colonization is completed, and it operates automatically from the inside out. One of the most salutary effects of my newfound freedom and control, I soon realized, was that I could revise my book anytime I wanted, any way I wanted, as often as I wanted, which I did, over and over, including adding the two long epilogues that conceptualize, via character in a dream I had, what being free, that was his name, is and should be, not just in relation to one's work, but in one's life. That lame distinction academics often make in an ineffectual gesture towards self-care. That my no book didn't exist in my professional community was a detraction, I suppose, but one very well compensated for in other ways. For example, I own the copyright, no small thing, can alter or use the material at my discretion, all instantly and for free. I can even unpublish it with the click of a mouse. Name a publisher that will let you do that with one of their books. This sort of chronic interactivity is impossible with a book a publisher owns, which is DOA before the ink is dry. Its publication more like a funeral than a birth or marriage, to borrow and hack into a set of metaphors Walt Whitman uses in his preface to Leaves of Grass, the closest thing in the 19th or 20th century to what I was doing right then. In other words, the book I made was alive, growing, changing, along with me, a relationship I reveled in. This fall went on to win a notable indie award in a book competition I submitted it for, and it garnered other plaudits. I could not be happier to have left the building in this way. Not just once for that book, but once and for all. In the meantime, I've written a passel of other books of personal essays and poems, making those similarly available instantly and for free on my website or at cost via online booksellers. I say in one of those books that had I stopped with this fall to find an approved outlet for it, a process I know from experience takes years, not minutes, I most likely would not have written the rest of them at all, being too preoccupied, first, by the formidable challenge of finding a taker for it, then by the endless and fastidious minutiae that are prerequisites for turning a living thing into the sort of corpse traditional publishers require before turning on those expensive presses. In each case, especially with the prose books, I made an effort, which I call attention to do something with the medium that would have been impossible if it were published via normal channels. Some of them have to do with form, some of them have to do with temporality, the way material is sequenced and blended. Some of them have to do with genre hybridity. Some of them have to do with intertextuality. Some of them have to do simply with weirdness, the kind marketplace metrics are far less tolerant of than I am. I have had a blast throughout. The other salutary effect my choice caused, as that conversation with my chair presaged, was that no respectable academic would deign to take it seriously. This self-published no book that doesn't count. I make an assortment of jokes about that in the fake reviews I inserted on the back page, all of which I invented on one of my more playful walks in the woods that fall. Instead, it found, and then belonged to, all those others who wanted to enter into an intimate conversation with me, not to learn something they could use to advance a career, but to witness something deeply personal in my life that reverberated with something deeply personal in theirs, a partnership of sorts, mutually beneficial, mutually pedagogical, a genuine democratization of the author-reader power dynamic. That book has since been vetted by a wide assortment of such wonderful and smart others, almost all of whom I have been in personal contact with, a number of whom are now my very good friends, people I would never have been in touch with directly, or maybe even become aware of at all, had I processed this fall through traditional channels. I say now, because of all that, that I don't publish my work. I share it. I have not, of course, made any money or accrued any professional status from all that. I would be ashamed if I had, for the reasons I mentioned. And my readership is relatively small. I know nothing about marketing, have no interest in learning about it. But the ensuing adventure has been breathtaking, not least of which is a sense that I may be blazing a trail toward this new way of sharing scholarly work that will become more and more common as the 21st century proceeds. The current system for that is clearly coming apart at the seams, at least economically. The number of publishers available for supplying books of this sort keeps declining as the expense to produce them rises, and the internal demand for them from professors who need them for promotions keeps increasing, in part because the status-obsessed powers that be in the contemporary academy keep upping the number of books required for those promotions, as if another book is identical with better. Something will have to give sooner or later. One day, most likely decades from now, given how slowly the academy adapts, my alternative trail may look appealing to other adventurers and become more well-traveled. Even more crucially, I think, this new way of publishing might inspire new ways of reading that transfer much of the responsibility for qualitative assessment over to the consumer, or to independent agents working on behalf of consumers, following something like the Wikipedia model, but with many micro-communities, providing reliable, review-related guidance to sort through the plethora of new material that online venues will be making available. Reducing the number of gatekeepers who wholesale goods to the marketplace comes with risks, of course, most especially in the quantitative disciplines, where the integrity of data being used for commercial purposes needs to be closely monitored. But my hope is that it will promote a more refined critical sensibility and a genuine sense of personal agency among readers, who will have to learn how to do their own vetting or find trusted others to help them with it in exactly the same ways that consumers of social media right now, quite urgently, need to learn how to discern what is real and what is fake in the endless streams of dis and misinformation inundating them, with AI looming and the long-standing firewalls that journalistic, political, and juridical arbiters once provided having been breached by various lunatic fringes competing for power in the dystopian landscape of our public commons, an ongoing slow-motion civil war that propagates cults and conspiracy theories like Cadmus's sown teeth, sprouting armed men. These culture warriors, marching now under banners like the Freedom Caucus and Moms for Liberty, are genuinely terrified, as they should be, that the ideals their names seem to be endorsing might somehow become universal, deprivileged in relation to race, gender, and class. The primary historical matrix for promoting that kind of democratization, which is literacy in the service of critical thinking, is the public schooling system. Anything, therefore, that hobbles it is not simply attractive to them, it is absolutely crucial for their long-term survival. Thus, the current obsession with book bannings and all the assaults on anything in that arena that has critical in its title. I'm surprised they haven't mounted a campaign against the concept of critical mass in nuclear fission, or the term critical condition that the media uses to describe so many of the victims of the gun violence that is being amplified exponentially by these very same warriors. Their goal is not to dismantle public education completely, reserving schooling for the elite, which would incite resistance, if not revolt, but to disable it so that it can't function as a significant threat to their preferred social order. That project started in earnest a generation ago with Bush II's No Child Left Behind, the effect, and I would argue the goal of which, was to transfer the center of gravity in K-12 education out of classrooms with their many local inside-out economies and into the stateroom with its one global outside-in economy. Stagnant funding that has left teachers' salaries in the poverty range in many states, driving many from the profession completely. A drastic shortage of teachers for all the obvious reasons, and a chaotic pandemic have accelerated the decline. That mission finally moved into higher education about 15 years ago with externally imposed outcomes-based protocols. Same ambition, same effects, some of which I witnessed during the late stages of my career. This assertion of governmental control has intensified considerably recently via state-level interventions in what and how disciplinary material can or must be taught in admissions, funding, and hiring practices. It reached a chilling watershed moment last fall via the tempestuous congressional hearings that resulted in the resignations of two presidents from elite universities. A stunning humiliation for what was once a revered paragon of independence. One that was made easier, I argue, in Quantum Reading versus the Rabbit Hole, by gradual corrosion from the inside out, what I call the corporatization of the university during the 90s and 2000s. All of which calls to my mind that gory, apocryphal anecdote that Chinggis Aitmatov narrates in The Day Lasts More Than 100 Years, in which Stalin plucks a live chicken to demonstrate how best to keep the people weak and dependent. In 1964, as I said, Marshall McLuhan believed we were on the cusp of a radical transformation in our ways of schooling. He would be aghast to see what that transformation has amounted to in the meantime. It will take generational work from countless creative individuals committed to working from the inside out to shift the balance toward his vision. I spent almost 50 years teaching writing, much of it at the entry level, by far my most enjoyable pedagogical arena. I witnessed firsthand how transformative it was when students experienced the excitement of realizing they could think for themselves. So I have a deep and abiding faith that good things can and will happen once our culture wakes up from its current self-induced nightmare. They will arise from the bottom up, not descend from the top down, one roomful of minds at a time. Moving towards some kind of direct from creator to consumer economy in the book culture is not a panacea, but it may make it easier and less expensive for consumers to find higher quality material than they are now likely to find for free in the social media circus tent, and to use that material to induce in themselves a genuine critical sensibility. And it may spur some of them to create and share their own work, not because it counts, but as if it matters. I said at the outset that I intended to document my career-long litany of dysfunctionality with the book. I've taken way longer than I intended to get this far. So instead of hyperextending my testimony manifesto, I'll just do a bullet point list of key moments. Number one, when I came into the profession in the mid-70s, the article was a legitimate and reputable credential in my field. And I wrote lots of them. I loved that medium. So breathtakingly efficient for making sweeping recommendations based on radical insights. Suited me to a T. By the time I came up for tenure, though, a sea change was taking place. The article viewed more as a way to publish a chapter or two from your book than to launch a new initiative. Suddenly, the book was the sine qua non. My tenure case was held up for months while I and others argued that what I had written was at least the equivalent of a book. But the fact that it didn't have the imprimatur of a publishing house and the artifactuality of two covers made that a tough sell. My case was finally approved with a sort of stigmatic asterisk, like those attached to sports records that are somehow suspect for steroids or gambling. Number two. So, as a gesture of evolutionary adaptation, I started writing my first book almost immediately, one that took nearly 10 years to finish and get published, at least in part because, given my temperament and my attunement to short-form writing, I was having difficulty adapting to its long-form prerequisites. One of the more bizarre constrictions of scholarly publication is that it was, and still is, quite easy to find an outlet for a piece that is 20 to 35 pages long, an article, and one that is over 200 pages long, a book. But almost impossible to find an outlet for anything in between. During this interim, I wrote two long-form pieces, each about 100 pages. Both of them were useless, I knew, given the available templates for publishing scholarly work. I had two choices. I could extend one or both of them to twice its length, which would have taken more years. Or I could cobble them together, which I knew would work, was the best way to use them, and could be done in months. I chose the latter, and I'm so glad I did. While the two may have seemed on their surfaces to have little consonance with one another, either generically or stylistically, I could see that their common ground was teaching, the by then much maligned counterpart to research in the economy of the profession, a thematic relationship that actually became much more visible in their partnership than it was in their separate states. So I wrote a long introduction, a clever interchapter, and a conclusion, as well as adding many gestural nods along the way, to make abundantly clear that the topic of my overall project did not inhere in either half, that is, autobiography and Plato, but to the whole comprising them. The result was writing/teaching, essays toward a rhetoric of pedagogy. It was an unusual book, hard to pin into any extant category, so I had as much difficulty getting it published as I did getting tenure, thus the 10 years. I won't go into the details. Suffice it to say that it was by turns infuriating and depressing, and it turned me off to the scholarly book marketplace before I even got into it. Surprisingly, to everyone, including me and my publishers, the book won the CCC Outstanding Book Award the year it came out, and it sold very well. So there. Number three. The following year, I put myself up for promotion to full professor, having met all the guidelines in place for that. A scholarly book since tenure, in my case a national award winner, teaching excellence, I had multiple university-level awards in that area, and dedicated service. I had a list an arm's length long of positions I had held, including several at the directorial level. What could go wrong? Well, this occurred precisely at the moment, the turn of the millennium, when the profession, at least in my field and in my department, obsessed with upward mobility in the national rankings, was going through another sea change, bookwise. Mid-level schools like mine wanted to emulate the next level up in some aspirational way, and there was no easier or cheaper or more stupid way to do that than to add a book to the expectations for promotion. Which is exactly what the Committee of Full Professors did at the very meeting that was called to consider my case. They rewrote the guidelines that day, rejected my application, and told me I'd need to write another book to be reconsidered. And since they had previously severely restricted the kinds of books that were eligible for consideration as books, preferring books that looked just like theirs, and used that ploy to deny promotion to a clearly deserving colleague, I knew I would have to be clever to accomplish that in a way that was not ethically offensive to me. Number four. And that's what I did. A process that took another 10 years, a kind of revenge tour, ending with a lovely book called Rereading Poets, The Life of the Author. my second foray toward full professor went very well, much to my surprise. I was certain there would be some other glitch or hoop or hurdle my senior colleagues would find to forestall it. But they didn't. The only blot on the scutcheon was the letter I received from the dean a few months later, which had a passive-aggressive air about it, as if he was ascending to the promotion only because he couldn't find a good reason to deny it, other than the fact that he didn't like me or the kind of books I wrote. He may even have put the word book in quotation marks in his letter. I didn't save it for posterity, so I can't check. The primary lesson this taught me was that the academic world cared way more about counting artifacts of a very specific and narrowly defined type, most especially in my era, the postmodernist critical theory book, which became first de rigueur, then a full-blown fetish, and finally a cliché, the only kind of book that really counted, than it did about the quality of one's intellectual enterprise. Which gets me, at last, to the final point I want to make about the two books I've been writing about. Specifically, how each of their authors defaults unreflectively to this material precondition, one that evades notice not by how small it is, but by how big it is. Neither of them mentions that move as problematic or even as a choice. Had I read them separately, as if they had no connection with one another, I may well have acceded, equally unreflectively, to those defaults. Reading them together, though, somehow made visible how their shared medium worked against, rather than with, their messages. As I said, this started as a vague sense about halfway through my reading that both books could and should have been shorter, more efficient. My hypothetical imagined range was about 100 pages, in, out, done. But there is simply no template in the print culture, even now, for scholarly books in that range. A no man's land, rather than my Goldilocks zone. A perfect example of how invisibly hyper-objective the medium has become. As I read further, a gnawing doubt began to grow about whether the book itself, no matter its length, was the best venue for what they had to offer. Why, I wondered, hadn't McLuhan used some combination of the AFI media of his day to make his point? Each element not a static description, little sparks discharging harmlessly from my fingertips every time I picked up his book, but an electric current, enough zip to zap me off my feet. His argument would have made more sense to me that way and would have had a much more intense impact. The inbuilt vitality of images and sounds replacing the sluggishness of words arrayed in sequences. In other words, the medium would be with, rather than against, the message. I answered my own question almost immediately, because this sort of a presentation lacks the cultural status of the book, most especially in the academic community, which is as hidebound in its orthodoxies as books used to be in their leather jackets. Beyond that, there is an ephemeral aspect to multimedia presentations, a there and goneness, that impacts not just their gravity, but their durability, especially given the rapidly accelerating rate at which technologies for archiving such performances keep evolving, threatening to leave content beached in unreadable oblivion, which McLuhan was aware of. The book might be snail mail by comparison, but at least it was a stable technology, easily portable, not dependent on the outside oomph of electricity. As to Morton, his most compelling material examples for revealing what hyperobjects do are the visual art pieces he comments on and the musical pieces he describes. He does provide a mid-book sheaf of illustrations of the former, but so far removed from his individual commentaries and so poorly rendered that they feel more like a skippable afterthought than the foundation for significant parts of his argument. And there is, of course, no oral component to his book at all. He writes copiously and beautifully about music along the way, and closes with a long encomium on various kinds of avant-garde sound compositions, most of which I was unfamiliar with. I tried to imagine, while I read, how much more impactful that would feel if I could hear cascading snippets of the amazing sounds he was describing, his commentaries either voiced over or visually staged via one of the many media formats available to him, amplifying the impact of his examples exponentially. I could, of course, have interrupted my reading over and over to search out a recording of the piece he was talking about, but that would not only take an enormous amount of time, it would be a chronic distraction from his line of thinking, the reason I was reading this book in the first place. At least during McLuhan's era, that last gasp of modernism, one could argue, as Eliot did a couple of generations earlier, that the tradition inflecting his book could and should be acquired before, not while or after reading it. In the information age, that is clearly impossible. There is no singular coherent tradition any longer, Western or otherwise. Only streams, lots of them, and the unscripted, serendipitous, hypertextual surfs they invite. It's possible that had I initiated one of those at some point during Morton's final chapter, I would never get back to his book at all, making it irrelevant. The ultimate insult to the scholarly tradition the medium is designed to reinscribe. The term aesthetic is foundational to Morton's discourse, the shimmering, oozing effects, affects of being alive in the world now that it has ended. The term synesthetic is similarly pervasive in McLuhan's discourse, the speed of electricity with which experience and simulations of experience are experienced. Both terms gesture toward the inviolably embodied materiality of their objects of interest. A book is, of course, an object. I've been leafing through these two repeatedly as I wrote all of this, and can be used to point to such things. But unless it is poetic, and these two don't make that cut, in my opinion, it is neither an aesthetic or synesthetic experience. More like an after-the-fact blueprint for a spectacular edifice than an animate rendition of the edifice itself. I understand why these authors felt they had no viable alternative in this matter. I just wish they had been more mindfully upfront about the consequences and limitations of that fact. That all of us in the business of scholarly enterprise would be more mindfully upfront about what this default medium, the book, does and cannot do. Not only as we exchange messages with one another, but even more so, how we create elaborate hierarchies of value. A status-obsessed collegial pecking order, for example, on its basis, one that regulates both literal and institutional sequences relentlessly from the outside in and remains functionally invisible from the inside out. All of which, I hope, makes clear why I see the book as an unacknowledged hyperobject in the academic marketplace, one that now exceeds any capacity of the culture that created it, even to comprehend it, let alone bring it to bay. Global warming between two hard covers.